everyone. This is Chris, and you're listening to the Live Fix Podcast, the podcast that explores the concert fan experience. We believe live music is life-altering. Join us as we share stories and connect with concert fans to discover how live music forever rocks our world before, during, and after the show. Greetings, live music fans. Have you ever wondered what it would be like if you went back and documented and reflected on the impact and meaning of every concert experience you've ever had? What would you learn about yourself? What would you discover about your love for live music? But what if you didn't do it? Would you forget some of your favorite concerts and what they meant to you? Would you not be able to get the real perspective of what your favorite shows meant to you in the full context of your life? These are just some of the things that we're going to dive into in this episode of Live Fix Podcast. That's right. On this episode, we talked to Various Artist. He's the host and creator of MyLifeInConcert.com podcast. For the last few years, he's been documenting and revisiting every live show he's ever seen from 1975 to the present. His podcast is about the concert-going experience. Rather than simply being a description of the performance, it's a mixture of concert review, music history, memoir, and philosophical musing. It's really great stuff. And it's right up our alley here on Live Fix. On this episode, we're going to explore the swell of anticipation that he felt leading up to seeing David Bowie live. We're going to look at what he remembers most about his first concert seeing Roxy Music in 1975. We're going to uncover why our sense of smell helps us recall our favorite concerts and concert venues. And what about the role of a concert fan tribe? We're going to look at why concerts are one of the most unique global communities we will ever be a part of, and why reflecting on that present moment of our favorite shows and the live music experience is such a cathartic force in our lives. And we're going to take a look at the power of journaling our concert experiences and how doing that puts this beautiful broader perspective and context on our live music experiences, and it also reveals what that life-changing experience that we feel during a show really means to us in the longer view of our lives. This is a good one, and we hope you enjoy the show. All right, Various Artists, thank you so much for joining us.
Hello, it's really nice to meet you.
Yes.
And hi, Chris and Colleen. It's great to finally talk to you. I've heard your podcast and really enjoy it. So it's great to finally get to be able to talk with both of you.
Yeah. Yeah. We're excited to jump into a lot of cool questions. You know, I think it was end of summer, late, early fall. I came across your podcast and your project and your experiment, journey, adventure.
He keeps talking about it.
Oh, hey, that's what I want to hear.
And every time we go on a road trip, it's like, let's listen to another one. Let's listen. And it ends up being listening to, you know, two or three of them. So we've definitely had you in our speakers.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, nice to be here. And of course, that's music to my ears to hear. So that's wonderful.
Yeah, because I came across this and I said, Colleen, look at what this guy is doing. He's journaling and cataloging his entire concert experience, and that's really what we're doing here at Live Fix is celebrating that, you know, the moments before, during, and after. And a lot of your mission, you know, of the My Life in Concert is to capture not just the music experience that's happening on stage, but you're diving into the meaning and the significance of that, throughout the whole experience. So we're really excited. And yeah, I've been, you know, Colleen's like, finally we get to talk to him, you know, all that stuff. So yeah.
What you were just saying there about the before, during, and after, that really resonated with me when I listened to some of your podcasts, when you said that, and I said, thought exactly, because it's more than just the music that you hear while you're there, because that's kind of like the centerpiece. It's like having the centerpiece of a meal, but there's all these other courses and things and social aspects that happen. It's the magnet, the center, but it's more than that.
And the dessert is how you get home, right? After the show.
Sometimes it's the dessert. It depends.
Yeah.
Sometimes the bakery is closed.
Yeah. Or if the bakery is thousands of people trying to get out of one lane in a parking spot, you know, in a parking lot for 5 hours, just depends, especially at some festivals and things like that.
Yeah. Yeah. It can be kind of a conga line sometimes, you know, getting out for sure. But what you're doing with My Life in Concert, again, is really remarkable. And we wanted to have you on to talk about kind of how it got started. I know we've listened to your very first episode, and you definitely take you know, your audience into like what inspired you. And we'd love to have you talk a little bit about that, because you're very descriptive in, you know, your first musical experiences, you know, as a, I think it was an 8 or 9 year old, 10 year old. When you were first discovering music, your influence of your, I believe it was your brother that introduced you to music and kind of built this this anticipation of going to a show. So here we are in, you know, 2023, and I believe in 2021, you began to catalog all these shows. So what made you want to do that? Or what was your moment there? Take us to there.
Well, first I want to back up a bit, because you were saying that I started to have this interest in music when I was about 8 years old. No, it's before that. I literally came out of the womb a music fan. Mm-hmm. And you talk to any of my parents' friends or older relatives who are sadly all passing, they will tell you. And that's kind of what's a bit different for me and other people I've met, in that for a lot of people, their interest in music kind of is an early teenage thing. And literally, it's my earliest memories. I've got a picture up on the website of me when I'm about one, trying to get into my aunt's stereo to put on the Hard Day's Night single. And so it's always been there. It's hard to, I don't know why, but it was. And I had an older brother and sister. They were a decade older, and it's the mid to late 60s. So groups like the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, the Kinks, the Who, I didn't discover them. I have no memory of discovering them. I just started remembering things, and they were there. So they luckily, the mid to late 60s, they had great taste in music, but it wasn't just that this was passively, the music was passively playing in the background. I was actively absorbing things. I was an early reader, because I love to read as well and write. And as soon as I could read, one of the things I did was look over liner notes and talk and read what every single person did. But it's funny, because sometimes, because I was young, I got the words wrong. For instance, I remember looking at sort of a band breakdown for whatever album at the time. And somebody played guitar, somebody played drums, somebody played keyboards. And I said to my sister, what is this instrument that this person plays? Persecution. And she said, it's percussion. it was things like that. So I had it's just endemic to me. One of the things I would like to explore more, because I also like the psychological aspect you bring in. Mm-hmm. And I know that, for instance, I have a real passion for the girl group singles of the early 60s. I have no memory of those singles being on the radio as new, but those records were on the radio as a child. I don't have memory of them, but there's just this connection. And I have a feel that hearing those songs at that time is tucked away deep in my unconscious. And it was there, because there's things that really resonate with me from before I have memories, but I don't know why. Hmm. So my interest in music went on for there. Of course, I've seen lots of live shows. I saw my first live show when I was 12, with my older siblings taking me to see Roxy Music in 1975, who then is now are one of my favorite bands. And so for years, I saw a lot of shows. I then got involved in college radio. I was writing. I worked in record stores. So I've known a lot of music people. And eventually I've collected a lot of my tickets, and I put them up on these two boards, sort of as a collage, as an ordered collage. And back in the day, to switch over and these two things merge, is, of course, when the internet came around, there's that website, salon.com. Do you know it?
Yes, definitely.
Okay, so I started reading Salon early on the internet. And in the late and I read it very religiously. And in the late 2000s, they launched this side project called opensalon.com. And it was amateur writers. First, they curated it, then they opened it up. And I started reading all these people on Open Salon. And in the early days, it was really interesting. They had a lot of really great writers. And I thought, and I hadn't been writing for a while. I'd sort of been working on this career, wasn't creative. And I thought, I want to get back to writing. And I thought, this is the avenue. But I thought, what do I want to write about? Because everyone seemed to be going, it was almost kind of Facebook-y, like, this is what I'm doing today. And I thought, no, I want to do a project. And it was going through my mind. So this is around 2009. And one day I was having breakfast. I was standing in the kitchen of our old place. And I was looking at my concert boards and I went, that's it. This is my story. I am going to tell the story. I'm going to tell the story of myself as a concert goer, but also talk about my life in music and also talk about the concert going experience. Because first, I wanted to relate these stories. Another thing that had happened is I would meet younger music fans. And we would talk about stuff and they'd say, oh, you know, I love the Smiths. And I went, well, I saw them twice. And they go, what? And they'd want to hear these stories about these groups they'd missed. And so I thought, okay, I'll write these. But I came up with a framework. I don't like, because some of these shows, there's some I remember in great detail. Others, it's more just a feeling or in general. So I decided I would do this. And I laid out all the shows. There's some compilation episodes where there's not a lot of detail, but I decided if I was going to do an episode, it had to fulfill one of three criteria. One, there either had to be a very strong review component, or two, there had to have been something like a story to tell, like something like we were talking about leaving a gig, as you've heard some of the podcasts, just getting to and from gigs as my young self with a lot of money in a different time, just all sorts of stuff can go wrong. Or there was an element to the gig or the artist or the time that would allow me to riff on an idea or something else. So that's been my guidelines. I started it on Open Salon in June of 2010. And within a few months, I had followers and I was doing really well. Unfortunately, Open Salon shut down in early 2015, taking my audience with it. So I kind of put mylifeinconcert.com on hold and then decided in 2019, I wanted to resurrect it as a podcast. And unfortunately, I was on college radio here in London for many years at Radio Western, CHRW. But what I found is that that was in the 80s, 84 to 92. And I've done a lot of public speaking. I've done a lot of interviews. I love doing all that stuff. But when I sat down to record the first episodes, I found out I'd lost my broadcasting skills. Mm-hmm. Excuse me.
But you didn't lose your memory, because I just feel like your memory is so amazing at these shows and just details. And I just wonder how do you tap into that ability to remember? Do you do like any kind of meditation? Do you listen to the music on the album? Like, how do you go back to that moment? Because you just do such a great job of putting a story and pictures to that story. And I felt like I was there when I was listening a lot of your podcasts. So I'm just curious, you know, because I want to be half as good as you as far as storytelling. I'm just wondering how do you go back to the 80s and really look at what you were thinking and what you're seeing, what you're feeling during those shows?
Well, before I answer that, I just want to speak to something you said, where you said you felt reading or hearing the podcast, you felt you were at the show. Mm-hmm. A number of people have told me that about that, and also the podcast, but also the blog. And for me, that is the greatest compliment you could give me, because that is one of the things I set out to do. I wanted, again, I'm not just writing a review of the show, I'm writing about the experience. And that was one of the things I wanted to pass along, that someone could hear this and get a feeling, not just the facts, but the feeling of being at the show, because live events are about feeling more than anything else. In terms of answering the question, half of it is an answer you won't like, and it's, I don't know. I don't know. You know, each one of us as a human being is so different, and we all have our pros, our cons, things we're very strong in, things we're not, things we have to work at, things that come easy. And for whatever reason, with this kind of thing, my memory's always been incredible. In my family, I'm kind of known as the family memory. Unfortunately, some of my older family members are passing, but it's been a thing through the years where, when did this happen? When did this occur? Ask me, because I would remember. So for some reason, I'm predisposed to remembering this, but also I think it has to do with music. I've had such a lifelong obsession with music that I think that's one of the reasons these particular memories are very strong for me. Why they're very strong for me versus other people, I do not have an answer for that question. Because even I wonder that too. Mind you, though, at the same time, if you ask me about a phone number, an address, directions to somewhere where I haven't driven in a while, the name of someone I met 5 minutes ago, I'll sit there and go, So I have an unusual memory. But the other thing, there's two other things that do help. You were mentioned going back and maybe listening to the music. One thing I've done is listen, especially if there's a bootleg of the show, or say with David Bowie's Serious Moonlight tour, I rewatched the Vancouver show, and that will trigger memories. Right. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is I have guests on, people that I've known through the years who went to shows with me or were there just at the same time. And I love doing those. There's another one coming up. There's actually a whole slew of those coming up. And those are my favorites because it kind of becomes like the movie Rashomon, where you have everyone is at the same event, but no one person experiences it the same way, nor do they remember the same details. So when you put people together and blend their memories together, often triggering memories in each other, you get this much more vivid patchwork and recollection of what's happening. So it's part of that. Part of it is just, I don't know why. Anything to do with music, I have a really incredible memory. And I usually map that onto years when records were released. And I use this to remember other things, such as, okay, so what year did I do that? Okay, well, David Bowie just put that album out. So that was January 76. I don't know. That's how my mind works. That's all I can say.
And there is a lot of research in attaching short-term memory to long-term memory events. There's a lot of research that if you see a show now and you can somehow a feeling or a note or what someone did on stage, an artist, if you can attach that to something that's stored in that long-term memory, because not everything is stored in our long-term memory. They say that that is there for good, unless there's a traumatic brain injury, which of course, you know, could happen to anybody at any given time, you know.
Yeah, and I think what you're, go ahead.
But that's what's happened with me with doing these interviews and with the people I'm interviewing. I just did one that's coming up for two UB40 shows that I saw. And it's my friend Phil, who's now in the UK, as well as this lady, Sky Sylvain. She's been a local broadcaster for years, but she was kind of the band's contact here, brought them to the parties. I mean, all her memories, but the three, and there was a big after party after the 84 show in this house, and all of us putting our memories together. Like I would say one thing and they go, oh yeah, right. And then they would do that. So I know what you mean about the memories being there, because talking to other people can trigger those. I say it kind of is recovered from the mental hard drive.
Yeah. And I think what really inspired us to talk with you is the fact that what you're doing by, you know, tapping into the power of oral history telling, you know, and cataloging this, because the further we get away from that era of live, you know, these eras of live music that you're you're chronicling, the less chance people will know what it was like for fans. You know, I think that experience, and in one of your podcasts, you mentioned about, you know, how you found your tribe. I think it was in 1983.
That's
right?
The Gang of Four show. Yeah.
The Gang of Four show. Yeah. And you mentioned, you're like, I finally found my tribe. Right. And then right. And I think about that and what you're doing combined with the other thing that you mentioned about, you know, I think it was different people you were talking with who didn't know who these bands were, what it was like to experience them live. You're putting that down and recording that. And that's powerful. And it's more important. Well, I don't know. It's important to see the live show from the, you know, recording of the artist playing it, but it's a whole other thing. And it adds so much more, I think, significance and meaning when,
depth.
When a fan shares, you know, what it meant to them. And like what you're doing is, you know, like, this is my life in concert. And that's powerful, because there's, you know, there's concert experiences that are really important and valuable. I think almost all concert experiences are valuable to remember. But a lot of those are going, you know, unremembered, and they, you know, and they shouldn't. So that's why I was like, man, look what various artists are here is doing. It's pretty remarkable. One, because of this, you know, the impact it can have for people, but two, what, you know, what Colleen was mentioning about just the sheer ability to remember all the shows. Cause I was like, we've had some conversations about like I can't remember like certain things, or I said something and she's like, no, that's not how it went. Right. Or like, well, yeah, it did. And she's like, no. So it's just cool to see what you're doing. Cause it helps to stitch all that together. But, you know, there needs to be more of what you're doing in that aspect of, you know, cataloging it, so future generations, future fans, you know, can experience these moments that changed, you know, changed music history, changed live music history. A lot
it's
of
like
the ones,
a concert historian or genealogist.
Yeah, concert genealogy, you know, emotional fan genealogy, and we're tapping into all these emotions. And unfortunately, a lot of the attention of what is cataloged is what's happening on stage, and mm-hmm. not necessarily what's happening in the hearts and minds of fans, like, you know, like we're saying before, during, after the show, which is what keeps, you know, keeps people going. And, you know, like, we're heading into an era where the live music experience is going to be, if not already, critical to the live music industry, you know, yeah. with how they're making money and, you know, the financial impact of it. It's just, yeah, it's just so cool for what you're doing. And it's interesting beyond, you know, to say the least.
Well, that was, well, thank you very much. And definitely that's part of it, is capturing that period. It's interesting because I've chatted with a few, especially because I'm here in London, Ontario, and I lived in Ottawa for 20 years. We moved back a few years ago, and I've reconnected with a number of people from sort of when I was going to a lot of clubs and that. And especially here in London, London is dead center between Toronto and Detroit. And it's 2 hours either way. It's equidistant. And back in the day, I mean, I go to Toronto all the time, and like, Toronto got everything. Everything came through there, and all these bands came from there. And I know a lot of people here in London would be like, oh, we don't have this. Like, Toronto has this, Toronto has that. Now, when we look back, it's like all these bands came through. We had a completely sustained local scene, and not every town gets to have that. So it's incredible also looking back and really valuing the experiences and just the people I got to see who are now gone, or the group is no longer together. Even something like the Talking Heads, they're all alive. I doubt they're going to play together again, but it's also getting older and really valuing what happened and wanting to have a record of that and let it be known. The one thing I'll also say about the remembering in terms of going forward with the series is, once I hit, it's around 88, I started keeping a journal, and I did it through till somewhere between 92 and 95. And that also just happens to be a time when I was seeing a lot of concerts. So once it gets there, it's going to be brilliant, because I have notes I actually took.
I'm curious, how did you actually journal? What did that process look like? Were you just writing facts down? Were you saying, it was, oh, I just left the show?
I see.
Details.
Well, then or now?
Then.
It was just, I started writing a journal. There was just a lot going on in my life. And I think a lot of people do that to make sense of things. And so I did that and I wrote it really religiously for years. So it encompasses everything going on in my life. But I was very heavily involved in music at that time. I had a radio show. I wrote for a local independent paper. I worked at the biggest record store downtown. Like, I just had a lot. I was very well connected at that point. And so it's not just about the music, but I have these fat, you know, series of journals where I would go to these shows and then would write details. So the amount of details that are there depend, you know, will vary from show to show, but I have something about any show I would have seen during that time because I would have written about it. Then there's kind of a period where I don't, but I also, when I started doing the blog in 2010, I started writing notes for every show. So every show I've seen from there forward, then on forward, I've got notes.
So your journal's a mixture of live music experiences and kind of your life at the time, and then they're mixed together, because that sounds super interesting. And I'm just curious, like, as you looked back, you know, at those journals, like, what did you learn? Like, what were some of your reflections of,
you know, I think my first reflection, you know, and looking at a lot of things was, what was I thinking? When you look back on that age and things that were just really, you know, big problems for you, because you're still working your life out. And some people's lives are more worked out than others. But I think a lot of people, when they look back, it's, again, what's the thing that youth is wasted on the young? Because now you look back, oh, why didn't I do this, 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 and this? And why was I worrying about that? And, you know, and other things is, why wasn't I worrying about this more? So in terms of overall, again, these are journals I kept about everything going on in my life. There is that sense of, wow, naivete. But in terms of the shows, it's just, I actually haven't done a lot of in-depth writing for them. I did one for, cause I did an episode, sort of a leap ahead episode, for one of my absolute favorite artists of all time. You may not know her, a woman named Lauren Nero, who is an incredible songwriter. If you go back and research her, she didn't have any big hits herself, but everyone else had massive hits with her, Fifth Dimension, Barbara Streisand, Blood, Sweat, and Tears, and on it goes. And anyway, she came out of retirement, and I did a podcast. No, I didn't do a podcast about that one. No, it was Keith Richards. Sorry, I did do a blog about that one. Keith Richards from 1988. And I dug up the journals for that one. And it's just incredible going through, because, oh, I would have remembered 10% of this, maybe. So these episodes that I'm doing, where I'm saying all these details, this is a fraction of what I could have remembered. So it's quite incredible for that one show, Keith Richards in Detroit in 1988. Again, just going through and it's like, yes, right. Oh, yeah. And I've got, like, the songs he played, like all these little small details that I went home and wrote. And it's quite neat because it really brings the experience back to you. And that's something I try to also focus on the podcast, is sometimes these little details are what you remember the most. These little things that happen on the way there, something you saw, something you heard, something somebody said, somebody, like, just some insane thing that happened. That's what you end up remembering the most, is the oddball stuff that sticks out. Also, too, what's happening in your life at the time plays a very, very big part. If you're going through a good time, a bad time, it really colors how you remember things.
Yeah. Was there a particular show? And I guess also maybe in general, like, how did the live music experience help you navigate a particular issue. Because when I was listening to you talk just now, and then also the, you know, how you've talked about it on your podcast, it got me thinking about going through shows. You know, I was, you know, dealing with stuff with, you know, my dad, or, you know, or family, or, you know, work or whatever. And I would go to a show and I would have, you know, you know, sometimes it'd be like an ambush of emotion, right? Like, oh, I didn't know I was feeling that. A certain song triggered something. And then I'm sitting there looking at the stage, hearing the music, but I'm also thinking about, you know, family and father and, you know, all these different things. And then I, you know, end of the show, I'm like, oh, okay. There was some cathartic, you know, after effect of that. And I was like, oh, I'm glad, you know, thank you, M. Ward, for, you know, allowing me to process that, you know, like live. Cause I would never have been able to do that if it was just me and at an album at home in my bedroom, right? Or, you know, at home listening to that by myself. Like, it was something about the live show that helped me process that, you know, who I'm with and everybody together. And I was just curious, you know, cause you've talked a lot about that in different aspects of the live music, you know, helping you do that. Do you have any examples of that, or like how did live music help you process different, you know, different moments and, you know, similar experiences?
Actually, you know what? One just came to me, because I mean, what you're talking about, it's kind of that effect of both catharsis and community that you have at the live event. And one for me, I've written about this actually. And it's one of the jump ahead gigs. This was a blog entry, and it's about seeing Patti Smith in 1995. And this was her comeback show. She'd been in retirement for years. I believe in Detroit, she'd played like as part of a few other shows, you know, like, but she hadn't actually performed as a headliner, Patti Smith, since 1979. So this was 1995, and she picked Toronto, the Phoenix in Toronto. And I remember we were excited. We were so thrilled. We got it sold out in a half an hour, and then they added a second show. But the person I went with, we went to the first show, and that summer, oh man, the summer of 95 was a really terrible summer. There was just all this stuff going on. And I have this weird mix of memories of all of this horrible stuff in my life, dotted by this series of incredible concerts I saw from, say, May through November. And it was like PJ Harvey and that year's Lollapalooza and Bjork and Sonic Youth, and then this Patti Smith show. And I don't know if you're Patti Smith fans or how much you know about Patti, but she was very important to me because I'd followed what it was happening in the New York punk scene from the beginning. And of course, she had been the catalyst for that and became this big star, and then sort of walked away with it with her husband, Fred Sonic Smith, who'd been in the MC5. And they had children, and she took, you know, all this time off. She did Dream of Life in 88, but then went back to obscurity. And in, I think it was 93, her husband, like Fred Sonic Smith, and her brother, who she was close to, died within like a very short time span. And clearly she and her husband were extremely close and very much a team. And so this was a year or two later, and this was her first live show. Like, there was no merch, no nothing. It was, the first set was actually her doing poetry, and then Lenny Kaye came out, and they did some songs together. And then later she did another set with the band. And, oh, I know what song it was. She debuted a few new songs at the set, and they came out a year later on her first comeback album, Gone Again. And one of them was a song called About a Boy. And she'd written it partly about her husband, but also about Kurt Cobain, mostly about Kurt Cobain. And about his death and the loss of that. And the band were doing it. It's a very, very intense song. And the song builds and builds. And it was at this moment where the song's at a crescendo and the band's just going really intense. So Patti, at one point in the middle of the song, when everything was at a crescendo and building, is she started doing, it was almost like an incantation, and she was raising her fist to the air, going, life is hard sometimes. Things don't always work out. It really hurts sometimes, but so what? Go on. And she was like chanting, live, live. And it's like, this is this person who had been dealing with this extreme death. And you could see she was almost in tears with just this, all this loud music culminating, and just this defiant positivity and, defiance that she's going to go on. And just seeing her on that stage, this small person who'd been through so much, and just the power and the positivity. And again, it was just, it was incantatory, and it was so inspiring. I needed to see and hear that at that moment. It was very, very inspiring. And again, it wasn't like this, hey, have a nice smile on your face. It was the acknowledgement that life can be pain, but life can also be a triumph. So that's a moment that comes to mind to me that was very special in a concert experience.
And you're reminding me, when I was hearing that story, I was thinking when I saw Kanye West at Lollapalooza in Chicago, and he's from Chicago. So I remember he was going through some similar stuff because his mom had passed, and he pointed to the area building that he grew up in, which was South Shores. And he said, Mama, this is where I started from. And it was like, it wasn't to the audience, right? It was like beyond the audience. It was like to the universe. It was like yelling, and and he had the mic to do that. So it's kind of similar to that experience. It was almost goosebumps. Like you felt like there's something bigger listening in on this experience.
Yeah. And it put things into perspective. You go through something like that, and suddenly you don't feel quite as alone, and you get this feeling of, okay, I can deal with things. And still went on to be kind of a crappy summer, but that was a really positive event, and it's always stayed with me. And it was wonderful to hear and experience that at that moment.
Mm. And are there any venues that you can go back and say, like, this just made, it was a different feeling of a venue, or maybe it wasn't a good feeling, maybe it was kind of a dark feeling? Or are there any venues that you can think of?
I can't think of any venues where there's dark feelings, but I can think of some that are really positive. One is, I just actually saw my first big show since the pandemic last September. One of my favorite band from the 90s, Pavement, and I saw them at Massey Hall. Have you ever heard of Massey Hall in Toronto?
No,
I've never. We haven't.
Okay. It's one of the most iconic halls in Toronto. It's from the 1890s. It just went through a massive renovation. It's one of the jewels of the city, and it holds about 3,000 people. And it was the Toronto Opera House when it was built in the 1890s. It's still a performing venue. So many classic albums and concerts have happened there. One of my favorite Neil Young albums is I'm a Neil nut, and Neil Young at Massey Hall is one of my favorite live albums. Also jazz at Massey Hall with Charlie Parker, Dizzy Gillespie, a classic live jazz album. Have you ever seen the movie Walk the Line about Johnny Cash?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. One of our favorites.
Multiple times. Yeah.
Okay. At the end, he's performing in quote unquote London, Ontario, where he proposes to June Carter Cash. That's the city I live in. But okay, that was at the London Gardens. What was the London Gardens? It looks nothing like that at all. Where that was shot, that's Massey Hall. That's Massey Hall.
Okay.
It's this hall that has this incredible history. I've seen many, many shows there. Lou Reed, The Stranglers, The Water Boys, all sorts of shows there. Just before the pandemic, saw Courtney Barnett and Kurt Vile. So whenever I'm there, it's always a bit of a special experience. I just particularly love that hall, the history that has happened there. It's a beautiful hall. The acoustics are amazing. And it also goes up. There's several balconies. So even if you're at the back, you're not that far away. So I don't really have a negative feeling with a venue, but that's a very positive one.
Is there a smell to that venue? I always think that smell is such an important part of the concert experience.
Yeah.
And can kind of make or break, or can bring up, you know, if you smell that again when you're out and about, it brings you back to those memories at that place. Is there a smell to it?
No, I know what you're saying, but no, I don't think there is. And that would have been, again, they just did this huge renovation to the hall. They found these stained glass windows that were part of it 100 years ago that they thought lost. They've all been restored. So no, not really a smell. The only thing that comes to mind for me is if I'm in a bar seeing a band and it's that smell of sort of like stale beer and smoke that it's universal.
Right.
The smoke now, but back in the day, but stale beer and that. But yeah. I know what you're saying, but I don't think I can place that for a show myself or a venue.
I have a lot of memories with fog machines, smoke machines, for some reason. I don't know. There was a group of bands that I think I went to in the 90s that I just, they just would put that on in the beginning, or they would put it on in certain parts of the show. And I just like, once in a while, I'll get that smell, especially around the Halloween. So people have them like in front of their house. I go right back to those shows.
Yeah, because it has a very, very distinct scent, and especially the closer you are to the stage.
I always thought if we were going to do like some kind of, you know, group, experiment to have a bunch of concert fans get together and you know, have them all have certain smells, you know, and see which could go back to their concerts, right? Because I have seen Colleen go into that trance when we're, you know, trick or treating or whatever with the kids. And I'm like, are you okay? Like, she's like, oh, I'm in Green Day 95 right now, you know?
Oh, wow.
And I'm like, oh, okay. You know, but I think that's, yeah, smell is the most, I think one of the strongest senses that is associated with memory. Mm-hmm. And, you know, whether it's, you know, the smell of pot, or, you know, smell of
or grass, if it's an outdoor festival.
Yeah. It's just like, I've had that before too. And it's always
or dirt. There's a lot of festivals that get really dirty and it rains, and then it's like mud and dirt. And you know, a lot of the Woodstock is, a lot of people will say that they remember just being muddy, a muddy field.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting because this is what's really interesting, speaking to other people, because I'm very focused on those sensory aspects, and I know what you mean in other scenarios, but not so much with concerts. So this is really interesting for me to hear that you make those connections. That's really, now you said that, okay, you mentioned a few things, but you said, are there any venues where there's a certain scent? Do you have an example of one, Colleen?
You know, I can think of, there's a club called Shubas in the heart of Chicago. It's you know the area better than I do, but
yeah, north,
we grew up in Chicago.
Yeah, the north side. Yeah.
The north side.
Yep.
And it is, there's history to it. It's got there's food there too. So
like
it's
a saloon.
It's like a saloon.
Yeah.
It feels like a saloon when you're walking in. And it's that wood, I could smell that wood floor, I swear.
Yeah, smell the wood floor.
I don't know if they do some kind of sanding or polish prior to going in, but there's a few shows that I would, if I could teleport myself, like every other weekend, I would be there. And it's a small dinky bar, but it's housed some really, a lot of country, America, like Americana type stuff. Yeah, and it brings back a lot of good memories there. We saw a few friends that were in bands play there. Maybe that's why. I just have a really, it just feels like a soft, like home, like you're going home, like a home away from home. And I think for some venues aren't like that. I can think of, I'm thinking of, there's a couple of venues I feel like in Chicago, they're just, were dark. The sound was bad. I didn't really particularly like Metro. We did a lot of shows at the Metro in Chicago, and I know it's an iconic venue near Wrigley.
Got a different feel to it, different smell.
But it's definitely very, to me, very sanitized, and it's just not a soft feeling to it. And I don't know, I guess I take in environments like that. That's just the way that I'm wired. So I could remember a feeling or an emotion about something, a show I went to that other people, for them, it was just a show. And it was just, you know, music and bands and people singing and, you know, mosh pitting, or, I mean, to them, it's very concrete. But for me, partly probably why I went into the field that I did, therapy, and was a counselor, is because there's just an emotional piece that I just carry and take with me, which could be good or bad, and depending on which venue or situation or concert that you find yourself.
Well, that's interesting. There's a few things you said there. Is first off, again, it's I hadn't really thought of the scent in that sense. But definitely having feelings about venues, regardless of the scent, that I get, especially halls I've been to or places I've been to a number of times. But the other thing you mentioned is how it, sort of like these people were at this gig, but for them it was a gig. For you, it went deeper. Again, that speaks to, I think for every, most people like some music, but some people are more deeply into it than others. And that kind of more deeper emotional or affective element that comes from a concert, not everyone can feel that. I always have this distinct memory in my mind when I was in university and I was studying English, but I took some arts courses. I'm a big art fan. And it was my teacher was a huge fan of Mondrian. Mondrian was his favorite artist. And he was trying to talk about his passion for Mondrian and these things that he would feel when he looked at these paintings. And finally, somebody put up their hand and it's like, what are you talking about? You keep saying it, but I don't understand what you're talking about. It's a painting, it's colors. And he sort of said, who in this room knows what I'm talking about? Just for any kind of art form, it could be music, it could be a book, a film, anything. Who knows what I'm talking about, where you see something and it kind of almost takes you out of your body? It's just really hits you. And of course, like, you know, I have five of those experiences a day if I'm with music. And it was incredible that about 60% of the class raised their hands and about 40% of the people sat there. And it's weird. It's like, wow, we are fundamentally so different. You have not had this incredible experience that I have all the time. And it's fascinating the different types of personality and how different types of personality process events. Again, why I like having different perspectives on things, because everyone experiences something differently.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. You know, Colleen says she didn't like Metro. I love Metro because I think it's got a different feel to it.
Why do you like Metro?
Because it's got it's dark, and when the show is on, you can see the band. It's lit, like it's everything's black around, except we haven't been there in a while, but they had the white pillars on the side, but. It's, I don't know if they do this intentionally, but it's everything's dark and black around, and the music is highlighted. And then when the lights go down, it seems like it just enhances the fact that everybody becomes one in the darkness of the crowd. Right. And you're like, it just like enhances this sense of community. Like we're all together. We're all looking at this and we're all experiencing maybe something collective, but also individual at the same time. So that's unique to Metro, because at Shuba's, everything's a little lighter, brighter. You can see the floor.
There's no balconies.
There's no balcony. It's like a saloon, like a dance,
The stage is very low. So, you're almost at the same level as the artist.
But it's great. Yeah, you can smell the dust on the floor at Shuba's. Your heels, feet click along the door. You know, and when the music's playing, you can hear people almost tapping their feet like to the music. So there. But at Metro, everything's a little bit. It's different because it's you know there's some different acts that might play there. But I have experiences of being dark. You're all focused on the stage, the light, and then you're just kind of brought together in that collective shadow I guess you would say, like, that is the audience, and it just has a different effect with that, you know.
But I like those differences. That's one of the things, going to different venues and different types of shows, because I know some people where, oh, I won't go see a big show, I won't go to a festival, and then other people just see big shows. And for me, I feel that I've been to some shows where, you know, they've been small, and I love that too, but I sometimes also love the experience of a huge communal show, because there's just this feeling. But you can get that in a bar. I guess the part of it is different kinds of shows have different experiential options or opportunities. So I like to go to different kinds of sizes of show, types of show, because it's kind of like a buffet. Why just keep eating off the same plate?
It's interesting to think about all the, yeah, I mean, if you go to a punk show, you know, I've been to different punk shows, you know, or, you know, metal shows or whatever, where there's a mosh pit and there's more sweat, you know, and there's a little bit of a stink, you know, everybody's sweating together, and you don't get that at all shows. Right. And there's this athletic activity. So when I go to that show, I've had that experience. And then when I find, you know, when I'm, you know, working out, or that I'm, you know, sweating by myself during a run or something like that, I'm like, I found myself going back to that show, because I could smell, you know, there's the smell of sweat, you know, mm-hmm. of my own. It's weird. It's a, you know, it just triggers it. So that's just the beauty of live music, right? And I think everybody has these different memories, you know, that will trigger us because of the sensory or the smell. And that's why we did this. I did this series of experiments on the five senses when we first started doing Live Fix. And I took the five senses and experimented with them at shows. So I never went to a Radiohead show before. And my friend was just like talking Radiohead, right, this and that. And I loved them. I think they were great. And I'd never seen them live before. So I asked him, what's the greatest experience, or why is Radiohead make, you know, what's the big deal about Radiohead live? And he said, oh, the combination of the music and the visual. So I was like, oh, okay. So I'm like, I'm going to blindfold myself for the first half of the show, just to see, you know, what would happen. So I did that. I had somebody with me that, you know, could kind of guide me, but I was at the show blindfolded. And I said, okay, at some point I took the blindfold off. So I removed, you know, the major element. And I was like, oh yeah, this is, you know, and it had an amazing effect, because it was like, it made the show even more, you know, compelling. And I did the same thing with St. Vincent, and, you know, experimenting with taste and sound and all these different things. But the five senses, I think, is something that we all collectively have, obviously, as concert fans. And it's amazing. It triggers all these emotions, and, you know, it makes the show what it is. With sometimes we don't realize it until we reflect, you know, back on there, or we're, you know, we smell fog and we're like, oh, Green Day, you know, or you're saying, you know, with the different experiences, you know, the smells is interesting, right?
Yeah. And it's fascinating, because I hadn't thought of it from that perspective. So it's really interesting to hear, you know, your thoughts and your, you know, what you've explored in this. So it's quite fascinating, actually.
Yeah. We wanted to ask you too about your experience. And we've been asking a lot of concert fans this, you know, since, you know, COVID put a stop to our concert adventures for a period of time. And I think we all went into a series of withdrawal from live music. Mm-hmm. And on your podcast and blog, you had mentioned, you know, the span of time that you didn't see a show. And then your very first show, I believe it was Caribou. Going back. But how was COVID for you? Like, not being able to go to shows, like, how did—
Oh, hated it.
How did you—
absolutely hated it. And I have an elderly mother, and, you know, my spouse and I, we look after her. So we had to be really, really careful. And we're very, you know, so we really had to cut ourselves off from things. And I found the perfect term for me a few years ago. I am an ambivert. And an ambivert is sort of a mixture of an introvert and extrovert. Part of me is very extroverted. Part of me is very, I don't know, introverted, but very thoughtful, very contemplative. And so I like having both. I have to, if I like, literally life is in my face 24/7, that's too much. But if I'm not, I'm a very social person. And so if that's cut off, it really, really depressing, especially since we had just moved back to my hometown and had really met a lot of new people. So it was very difficult. But part of it was, you know, live music and at the depth of COVID, where you don't know what's going to happen. You don't know where this is going. I mean, we have ideas now, but in the midst of it, you don't. And it's like, is this going to go on for years? Am I going to see a show again? And it's interesting because I have, and this made me feel good, is that for years, especially now that I'm getting older, I've been very, very conscious when I go to shows to be really appreciative, being able to go to the show, that it's there, that I have the health, that I'm alive to do it. And, you know, especially with my partner who likes live shows, but maybe not as much as me. It's like, look, you know what? One day we're not going to be here, or we're going to be incapacitated and it's physically impossible. We have to celebrate and, you know, and really understand how special this is, because life is so fleeting and health can be fleeting. So I really made a considered effort to really appreciate these experiences. So I did take comfort from that in the middle of COVID, thinking, okay, I'm glad I appreciated these experiences, that I didn't take them for granted. But at the same time, it's like part of your life is gone, especially if going to shows and live music is, it's not just something, hey, you know, I might do that from time to time, but it's an important part of your life. You really feel like part of you's died. So when I went to that Caribou show, it was so extraordinary just to be back in that situation. And again, I was at the back. Usually I'm the kind of guy who's right at the front. But it was just the music, everyone there, just seeing people enjoying themselves, all of it. It was just, it's a gig I'll never forget. It was a really, really special gig and it was incredible. And again, I've been seeing a lot of local, I've kind of connected with the local scene. And there's been this thing here in London, especially centering around the Richmond Tavern, which is one of the oldest places in London. It's been a tavern since the 1850s here in London, Ontario, still operating. And a lot of bands play there. And I've been reconnecting with a lot of people I knew back in sort of the punk and alternative scene from the late 70s and 80s and early 90s. And I just get this feeling that a lot of people, first off, are out doing a lot more things and appreciate things a lot more. And I feel that people are putting value on going out and the communal aspects of music and community.
Mm-hmm. And I know you talked about some of your, a couple of the concerts that you did in the past, but one that I wanted to ask you, that I saw that you did a podcast on, was the Police Picnic. And I think you went to multiple.
There was three.
Like two or three. Yeah.
There was three consecutive years.
Can you talk on those and how that experience was? I'm a big Police fan too. So
it's interesting because I just had coffee with an old friend of mine, actually one of the people I've reconnected with. And we were talking about these, but before the Police Picnic, because the Police Picnics, they were in and around the Toronto area in 81, 82, and 83. But in the summer of 1980 was the biggest one of all, Heatwave, which was an all-day festival, which is the greatest. The Talking Heads at Heatwave, that was the first time they'd ever played as an extended band. And it is the first time they played any material from Remain in Light or debuted their new sound. So I got to hear, I was one of the first people in the world who got to hear Once in a Lifetime, and it was incredible. And Elvis Costello was there that day, Pretenders, B-52s, Rockpile. So the next year, it was different people put it on. The Garys from Toronto put on Police Picnic. Now, the first one took place way outside Toronto. It was actually just in this open field in Oakville. And it was, now I know the Police had been doing these over in the UK, And the Police, I think this point they'd become huge in the US, but they had been, I think, bigger here in Canada a bit longer. And a lot of those bands from the new wave, they were a lot bigger here than in the US. And so the Police, I don't know who put it on, they headlined this all day festival with 10 bands. And the next two actually were dead in the center of Toronto at the old CNE Stadium, which is sadly now gone, long gone, because when Skydome opened up, it made the CNE Stadium sort of irrelevant. So the first one, it was an amazing day of music, particularly for me. I'd wanted to see Iggy Pop for years. I'm a huge Iggy fan. That's the first time I saw him. Also, the other huge act was the Specials, and that was the number one reason I was going. And well, the Specials and Iggy, and the Specials were brilliant, and they broke up a few weeks later, so I got to see one of the last shows of the original band.
Wow.
Now, as for the Police, it's interesting because I've gone through waves with them, because I really liked. I remember early 79, I heard Outlandos D'Amour and loved that. And then later 79 was Regatta de Blanc, which is still probably my favorite. The two in the middle, Zenyatta Mondatta, I'm not too keen on. And the thing is, it had been a really long day. There were 10 acts on. There was the Go-Go's, who we didn't know they were, this is before they broke. It was like the Go-Go's, Killing Joke were amazing. It was all these bands. And the Specials came on, I think, 9 or something like that, and played like till about 9:30. The Police took forever to come on. A little bit of phlegm.
And that can kind of ruin a show if an artist takes their time to get on. Don't show up. I mean, nowadays, unfortunately, you hear of artists not showing up or showing up 2-3 hours late. And, you know, people now with the social media, they can get on, you know, Twitter or Facebook or TikTok and, you know, say, I paid the ticket, like, where's the artist? You know, but it can really ruin the vibe of the show. And it turns a lot of the fans really get angry, and then it changes the vibe.
Well, I mean, for us, we had enjoyed the day. You couldn't kill the day because it was so great, but we left. I mean, they came on, they played a few numbers, and they were so listless. Now, in doing the podcast with my friend Phil, who was here at the time and now lives in the UK, he reminded me, like, we were both saying, they were not at their best. They were like boring. They were dragging. And one of the things I'd forgotten was Sting saying his voice was almost gone. And now in retrospect, probably the reason they took so long to come on is trying to wait for the best, like for his voice to recover. But after being out in the sun for that long, and of course, all the sets ran late, like they didn't come on till I think almost midnight. And so we left, and that became the very first show I ever walked out on, where I walked on a headliner. We left. We were just exhausted, burnt out. They weren't very good. We left. So the next year they had Police Picnic 82. For that one, they moved into downtown Toronto at CNE Stadium. They also slimmed down the bill to 6 acts. That concert actually, in terms of a concert experience, was and is the worst concert experience of my life. We were sort of a lot more, I was, you know, part of a party crowd, and we wanted to take some uppers pills to keep us going. We bought bad pills. We got sick. The sound was bad. It was our first big festival. We smuggled in all this booze, not realizing that we had seats in the stands. So when we got in, if anyone wanted to use the bathroom, we wouldn't be let back in. So we had to go the day without going to the bathroom, which would be impossible for me at that time. And the people around, it was just all of this bad stuff. At the end of the day, there was the Talking Heads were second last. So I saw the Talking Heads once again. They were brilliant. They'd fixed the sound by then. And then the Police were great that second year. Very, like, totally different between the two shows. So there was a big difference. And then Police Picnic 83 back at CNE Stadium, Had an amazing lineup, a lot more, a funkier lineup. James Brown, who actually was a disappointment to me. I really wanted to see him. But Peter Tosh was amazing. King Sunny a Day. And I felt that third concert, the Police were at their best. And we're talking about a moment in time. It was really incredible because this was a couple of weeks after Synchronicity came out. And Every Breath You Take had just been this huge hit. And so when I saw them, that was maybe just coming down the charts. Synchronicity was a few weeks old. It was probably, they're probably the biggest band in the planet at that moment. And there was an incredible energy to the show. It's also, I really like Synchronicity. That would, the first two and the last one are my favorite. And they were on fire. Again, they had been very famous for a number of years, but with that album, they went to a whole other level of fame. And one of my feelings is that one of the best times to see a band is when they've just made some sort of jump in their career. And that could be from, you know, having the bar half full to packing it out, to playing a bigger club, to paying a hall, to playing a festival. When somebody's taken that jump, like when I saw Pearl Jam at Lollapalooza, and they had exploded. They were way down on the bill. Yeah. And by the time the concert went off, they were huge. Mm-hmm. And it's that feeling. And so I feel with that last Police show, it was the best of the three. The other thing that happened during their set, this is significant. It's the first show I ever saw. Now this, especially younger people listening to this, if they are, will go, what? The first show I ever saw at a stadium or a massive show with a Jumbotron. So it was like, oh my God, you can see all the details of the stage. And at one point they took a break and went backstage and had a cup of tea backstage, and the cameraman followed in the back. And of course there's 60,000 people like just going nuts. And it's kind of cheesy now, but at the time it was totally new. And it's like, holy crap, wow. And the fact that you could go see the big show, have the audience, but with the Jumbotron, you got to see some of the details. That was new. And it was during that Police set on that tour that I first experienced that. And of course, that's now a standard part of concerts.
So prior to that, you just didn't get to see the little details on stage.
No, they were just gesticulating lumps on the stage, and that's all you did.
So you sight, right?
What's that?
Sight. Going back to the five senses. In that case, it was sight. You know, not necessarily what you were hearing, but what you were seeing. That was the button that was pushed. Was the, you know, what was elevated was now you could see, which enhanced what you were hearing, and then like you have this, yeah, like you have this memory now of like you know, being able to see and take that tea backstage and come back, and it was like, whoa. You know,
Interesting because I did a podcast on that, and there was three of us, all three of us. Like we told, that's again, all this great music. The band was on fire. They were amazing. What's the thing that all three of us remembered? Them going backstage and having the cup of tea. Because yeah, it's absolutely crazy? Unique. It's singular. Yeah. So it stands out in your memory.
Yeah. Yeah, that's awesome. I love that. You know, those moments. I think that's, you know, again, that's why we do this whole show, and that was why we wanted to talk to you, because I see you're doing the same thing and cataloging those moments and celebrating those those moments. And we wanted to ask you, because I know we asked you before the show to fill out some things, and we wanted to dive in a little bit to those. We've already covered some of the stuff that we've already asked you about, but your first moment. Live music experience, I think you said, was Roxy Music February 8th, 75.
1975. I was 12.
12 years old.
Who are you there with?
My older brother and sister and his then wife and their friends. And again, like by this point, I mean, most people at the 12, they're maybe discovering music. I'd already been through, you know, the end of the beat boom, psychedelia, hard rock, singer songwriter, glam rock, and you know, it was the mid 70s. So I'd already been through several pop culture cycles. And also my family comes from the UK. I was the first one born in Canada outside of the country. And I was always very closely followed what was happening in Britain. We all did. And certainly in the early half of the 70s, it was, we called it glitter rock then. And I liked, then as now, I like different kinds of music, but that was like it for me, like Bowie, Roxy Music, Mott the Hoople, Suzy Quatro, Lou Reed, all of it. And so I had I'd known of Roxy Music since 72, but it was with the second album, which I got right at the start of 74, For Your Pleasure, still one of my favorite albums. And again, that album, these experiences would be very difficult for young people to imagine, but I've had a lot of experiences where, like that album, when I heard it, the first time I heard it, it's hard to say that I had an opinion because it was so completely unlike anything I'd ever heard. I didn't even have the words to describe how I felt. It was so foreign. This happened a lot to me during the post-punk years, which were so experimental, where it seems like every 8 weeks you'd hear some new band that totally changed how you thought about music. So I was like, I just became a huge Roxy fan. I still am. I still listen to all of those albums. And I finally got to see Brian Ferry again in 2016. But it was kind of a thing. It happened at the last minute. Because I was staying with my sister and brother-in-law. I was slated to stay at their place downtown, and they owned the really cool downtown. It was a unisex haircutting shop called Roxy. And it was just, well, how about, would you like to come to the gig with us? And I'm like, are you kidding? Of course. And it's like, I think back, you know, there's times in my life I've been lucky, times I've been unlucky. Well, I hit the jackpot with that one because it was an amazing show. The band were incredible and it's unforgettable. And the two things I most remember about that, first off, is Brian Ferry's mic was dead for the first two numbers. They started with Prairie Rose, which was, they were touring the Country Life album. And they started with Prairie Rose and the whole band's on stage except for Ferry. And the song, they're doing all the intro and then he comes out kind of like a lounge lizard, snapping his fingers, steps up to the mic and nothing, silence. Mm-hmm. So that was really incredible. The other thing was I had been wanting to go to shows for years, like the year before. 2 years before, like the New York Dolls came here in 73, and I was like, you know, what, 10? And it's like, oh, I want to go. But I had it in my mind. I don't know why, because you'd see maybe ads for the tours, like they're touring this album. Like, you know, they're promoting this album. For some reason, I had it in my head that the band would come out and play the album, like you, the first track, the second track. And so when I was going to see Roxy, Country Life had just come out here a few weeks earlier and I had played it to death. I thought, well, I'm going to hear this track. And gee, I wonder if maybe some fluke that they might do, you know, editions of You or something like that. It didn't occur to me that they would come out and do a selection of material and the new album would be part of that. So it was like, oh, even when they started with Prairie Rose, it's like, oh, well, maybe they don't do the songs in the same order. And then they started doing this older material. It's like, yeah, wow, you know, the wonders of modern science. Wow. So,
and during this time, awesome. Do you feel like, explain how were your parents very supportive of this? Or was it more your siblings that really pushed and encouraged the music? Or did they have a big, were they doing a lot of shows at that point? Were they going to a lot of shows?
Yeah.
I guess, what was the culture like in your family? Was it very encouraged or was it kind of sneaking to go with your older siblings?
No, it was definitely my older siblings, not my parents. And I'm the youngest in the family. So, I mean, it's funnily enough, I'm interviewing my mother this weekend, who's 96, for my podcast, because we went to this cabaret show in England in 77.
Oh, great. But
my parents are from that pre-rock generation. Mm-hmm. And my older, like, so when I was, like, I saw Roxy Music, they would have been like 22 and 24. And music was just something that was always in the house. And I also talk about how a lot of my music epiphanies didn't come from the radio necessarily, but because they, even then, they were very cutting edge in the late 60s, all the hippie groups, and of course, all the bands coming out of England, but also they had a lot of friends. The friends would bring over records, so I get to hear all their records. And so absolutely, I mean, it was that period, the late 60s, the 70s, all those incredible bands. The records were playing in the home. I knew all of them. I would study the liner notes. You know, I remember Elton John's Goodbye Yellow Brick Road coming out, and we'd play it. And I did this massive poster I wish I could find, where of like the album cover, and read all the music press. So no, they were going to all the shows. They went to all the really cool and interesting shows. And I really wanted to go. So that's where it came from. My parents were from a completely different era, but they're British. And I don't know, my interpretation is for a lot, I don't know. It's weird because they weren't into it, but I think it was just different times, and it was totally normal for a lot of teenagers to be listening to music, going to shows. And I think because so much it was from the UK somehow, even though they didn't get into it, it made sense. It's interesting because my parents hated all the rock music from that time. Maybe a few early Beatles songs, that was it. But it's interesting how music gets recontextualized with time. So when I go to my mother's house, she'll have this station on, and it's oldies, but it kind of goes into the rock era. And I mean, I was there a few weeks ago, and they were playing, and what came on with the Kinks' Dedicated Follower of Fashion. And she was walking around whistling it. It's like, you would have hated it. Back in the day, it would have been, this is a load of bloody noise. But because of the familiarity of time, it kind of becomes enmeshed in your world, as it were, sort of a time. Like, I think my mother, you know, didn't like the Rolling Stones and that, but now it's like, okay, well, I know who Mick Jagger is. So, you know, and the songs are familiar, even if I didn't like them. So kind of time works its way into you.
And how did your brother get into live music?
He's a musician. I just saw him play live a week ago. He's still playing at the Lowdown Dirty Mojos, who just won the Canadian Maple Blues Award. So he was like the first live, actually, I'm thinking about it, the first live band I ever saw, really saw, was his band in the late 60s playing the New Year's Eve party that he had at the house. So this was completely around me. I was surrounded by it, but I wasn't, again, there's other things that were around me as well, and I wasn't picking up on those. Music always has had a special resonance for me. Again, why? I don't know, but I'm glad it did. And going to live shows, again, I love the records. I love listening to music. That's huge. But going to a show is different. It's more than just the music. You're in this unrepeatable moment in time. And also, anything could happen. Even if you're seeing a show that's very choreographed, where things happen, things don't always go right. And that's what you remember. So it's the uniqueness of the experience, but also the communal, the catharsis and community, because shows can be very cathartic, but it's this sense of everyone has arrived at this place to see this. And there's this kind of, especially a really intense moments in the show of kind of bonding. You're talking about the tribal thing in the other episode. That happens. And I think it's one of the reasons people go.
You mentioned one thing that I wanted to ask you about too. And it was super interesting, you know, about the idea of when does the concert experience actually start? You mentioned that about, it starts when you hear about the concert or
when you wake up,
find out about the artist and you get excited, like Tell me more about that, because I think that was really interesting. And it, again, it gets into that aspect that we explore here about, you know, the before, during, and after. And I thought it was really interesting hearing you talk about that, of like, when does the concert experience actually start?
Well, I wasn't asking that as a rhetorical question. It was open-ended. I mean, I have my own interpretation mm-hmm. of that, but I was putting that out as something to think about, because for some people who are maybe less engaged about something, it can just be going to the show. But I think if you're very involved in music, especially if you're part of a music community, which happened later, where, you know, Iggy Pop will be coming to town and everyone, you know, is just kind of like five, you know, 10 days to the show. So for me, the concert, again, the whole concert experience can start with just hearing about the show and the, oh, okay. And then buying the ticket and then the anticipation and thinking about it. And also, unless you're going to the show alone, who are you going with? What are the plans? What are you going to do before? Are you going to hang out before? What might you do after? And I think that, you know, you have the core concert, which is the music playing, but you can't take that out of the context of everything else that's happened, because even when you're there experiencing the show, that experience is the result of a process that started sometime in the past. And it brings, it's kind of like sucks in everything, all the entrails that have happened, starting from hearing about the show till there, and it accumulates, everything accumulates in this event. So yeah, it's interesting. And also too, with talking about the gigs, that's something I wanted to emphasize, is bringing in all these small details, talking about the before and after, because that really is part of it. I feel that when you read a review for a concert, especially in a newspaper or, you know, that kind of a publication, and I understand, you know, they only have so much space and there's even less of that these days, but it seems almost disembodied. It's almost like the person just beamed in to this space, doing nothing before. They're sort of encased in glass. They don't smell anything. Nothing's going on, that just the concert, and then they beam out, which is, of course, not how it happens. There's all these things that happen around it, and I feel that that is part of the experience, and it's an important part of the experience and needs to be talked about and celebrated.
The question I have is, if you had an opportunity to see anyone, any artist, past, present, we don't know whose future gonna come out and evolve, right? But past, more so past and present, who do you choose to see and why?
Well, I'll answer that. I'll also say I do have an episode devoted to this, 20 acts I wish I'd seen, where I go through the decades and list 20 acts I would love to get at a time capsule. See where, when, why. The one I'm going to pick is the Beatles. My two favorite band, probably my three favorite artists, would be the Beatles, the Velvet Underground, and Bowie. Well, I saw Bowie 5 times. I saw Lou Reed 3 times, John Cale 2x. I never saw the Beatles. So it would probably be the Beatles. And I put up on there when I would like to see them. It's at this moment that is lost to time, and I don't know where it would be, but I would like to have seen them in the UK just as they were breaking. Like, I know a lot of people would like to have seen them at I can't believe this, I'm Beatles Not All My Life and I'm blanking, the Cavern. And I would like that too, but it would have been neat to see them, but they didn't do their own material at the Cavern. It would have been neat to have been able to see them when they were playing some of their own material, but they weren't being drowned out yet by the screaming, somewhere sort of where there's a buzz about who you're going to see, but you could actually hear the show. And I don't know, that's lost to time, that moment. But I also do another podcast about 20, well, I updated it to 22 shows I missed, shows I was supposed to see, I had tickets for, and they didn't, for a variety of reasons. And I go through each show why I didn't go. And out of that 20, the one that's the biggest regret as it was canceled was Bob Marley in 1980. And of course, that's when his cancer started spreading and the tour got canceled. And I had tickets for him here in London, December 1980. That's the, like, there's a lot of shows where it got canceled and I couldn't go, but that's the biggest regret. So
and now close. Did you journal about experiences that you didn't get to see as well?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Well, when I was journaling in that period, and one of them I talk about and actually have part of the journal, and it's, I'm a huge Sonic Youth fan and I saw them many times back in the day. And I've actually met Lee a few times. I've interviewed Kim Gordon and I saw them many times, except for when they played, what was the venue in Toronto? And I saw Thurston Moore there a few years ago. Anyway, they were supposed to play the Concert Hall, which was a venue in Toronto. I saw many bands there. And this was the fall of 1990. And I went with someone, and this is, I was in university. It was in the fall. I was an English student. All my papers were coming due. I worked at a record store to keep a roof over my head. I had to take a night off to go to this concert. And we get there. It had been moved at the last minute to this new venue. And we get there. It's oversold. So we're waiting, trying to get in. And there's like a huge crowd outside because they've way oversold it. They moved it to a smaller venue. Who knows why? And people were starting to get very, very angry and tensions were bubbling over. The cops showed up. They went in. They actually shut the gig down. And there's footage online of this and the aftermath. And so I wrote, it's all in there. I've actually got on that blog, it's one of the 22 shows I missed. I've actually got a snippet from my journal. We went all the way in, all in block letters. We went all the way there for nothing. It was the worst. Like 5 exclamation points or whatever. So yeah, that was, all of that stuff is in there. Also at that point, I was on CHRW for years. And I also wrote in the local paper. So I was also interviewing a lot of people and a lot of artists. And so I not only have the interviews from that time, but also writing about it in my journal. So all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, that's amazing. Yeah, we've been in some situations where we got, I think it was Smashing Pumpkins.
Postponed.
Postponed, and we're like, no. And I did the same thing. I wrote a blog post about it, and I was like, you got to be kidding. You know, and we interviewed fans that were upset there, and it was a part of, we did this emotional experiment live there, and, you know, it was same thing. So you're bringing back some memories there.
Fans were came from all over. It was very, and yeah. I don't know why they just didn't communicate it too well that it was postponed. It's
frustrating. Well, that's really, like, I don't know if you know who XTC is. They're a British band.
Yeah.
A huge XTC fan. They're one of the 22 acts I didn't see. And it wasn't canceled until the last minute. This is the fall of 1980. And this is when Andy Partridge started having his huge performance anxiety, and literally they stopped touring after this. But it was such a downer because we'd also been preparing for the show and I was a teenager. So then I might've had to go home in a highly altered state and have a conversation with my parents. But that was such a drag getting there. It's like, what do you mean it's canceled? We've been looking forward to this for so long. And I never saw them again. They never toured. That was it.
I feel like we need to get every concert fan together and have this, session of, we can all, have
the
this
trauma of something being canceled.
Trauma session, and just get that all out together. I think we all have these like experiences, to just process.
But that's it. Seeing shows also means not seeing shows. That's part of it.
Yes. Yes. Well said. Well said. Yeah, it has been fantastic talking to you, various artists, and it's just so great to be able to hear your stories again. We've just had a ball, a great time. I feel like we could keep talking here for so much longer,
maybe we need to have you on again for part 2.
Absolutely. I'd be open to it if you're up to it. This has really been a pleasure because both of you, I can tell from your podcast, but also speaking with you, is you're big music fans and live music fans. So it's incredible to be able to talk about this stuff, but also hear about some of your perspectives and things that you focus on. So I have enjoyed this immensely.
I think there's a smell I will always associate with our conversation with you. I don't know what that is yet, but there's always a St. Patrick's Day. I think I will always
I think the smell would be beer. I think that would be it's St. Patrick's Day.
An beer, Irish, I think would an Irish saloon somewhere or something, maybe. Well, you for got those it. Of you. For those of you that
with
that's
a,
when we're
with a leprechaun guess, for
right?
sure.
Now everybody knows what day we recorded, I guess, right? Yeah.
Oh,
leprechauns.
Yes.
Leprechauns. Right. And yes. Yeah. No, it's been fantastic. Thank you. Thank you so much for joining us. And we hope to have you back. Sounds like you're open for an encore. Just like a good artist should do, right?
So. Excellent. Thank you so much. I've really enjoyed this. It's been a great experience. Thank you so much for asking me.
Thank
and
you.
Everyone listen to mylifeinconcert.com. There's a plug.
Yes. Mylifeinconcert.com. Absolutely. Go check it out. We're huge fans. And yeah, thank you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks again.
Live Fix Podcast is a production of Live Fix Media and is produced by Chris and Colleen Catania. Hey, we know every concert fan has a live music story to share, and we'd love to share yours in a future episode. So head on over to livefixpodcast.com and click on Share Your Story. We look forward to hearing from you. Like what you heard? Did you get inspired by the stories of your fellow concert fans? Then help support Live Fix Podcast by subscribing and sharing a review on iTunes or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast. We appreciate your support, and thanks for listening.